From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Until this administration, it had been possible to believe that by upholding the policies of my president, I was also upholding the interests of the American people and the world. I believe it no longer.
Former State Department diplomat John Brady Kiesling joins us to explain why he resigned to protest the Bush invasion of Iraq. We go to Tulsa, Texas, where the state court is prepared to toss out 38 convictions in a 1999 drug sting that framed 15% of the town's African-American population. And Cliff Candy, a member of the Iraq peace team, joins us in the studio just days after leaving Baghdad.
One of the dramatic events of my past week was coming out of Baghdad on Saturday. We had a car accident outside the western Iraqi town of Rutba. We were taken to the little village there. We were treated at a primary health care center, but this was also in the same town that had been hit just 3 days earlier by U.S. air attack, where that small children's hospital was taken out.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. forces have begun a major attack against Iraqi Republican Guard divisions surrounding the Iraqi capital. The Associated Press reports B-52 bombers carpet-bombed Karbala throughout the night. Third Infantry units surge past the strategic city without entering it. In the nearby farming town of Hilla, the local hospital director said 33 people were killed and more than 300 wounded in a bombing raid yesterday. A spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross told the Agence France-Presse, quote, there were dozens of smashed corpses at the hospital. The London Guardian reports unedited TV footage from the Babylon Hospital showed horrifically injured bodies heaped into pickup trucks. Relatives of the dead accompanied them for burial. Bed after bed of injured women and children were pictured along with large pools of blood on the floor of the hospital. An Edinburgh-trained doctor at the hospital, Nazim al-Adali, told The Guardian all of these are due to the American bombing to the civilian homes. He said there were not any army vehicles or tanks in the area. One stunned man who lost his whole family said, God take our revenge on America. An AFP reporter saw what appeared to be the component devices from cluster bombs covering a large area in the town. This comes as the Washington Post reports today U.S. military commanders have shed their early caution in striking some targets in Baghdad and have embarked on more aggressive air attacks that run the risk of larger numbers of civilian casualties. The change in tactics appear to reflect a judgment that winning the war against Iraq will require more aggressive air attacks. An AFP reporter also encountered a civilian sitting among 15 coffins at the Babylon Hospital. Razak al-Kazem al-Kafaji said the coffins contained the bodies of his wife, six children, his father, his mother, his three brothers, and their wives. They were killed Monday night when a U.S. helicopter gunship fired on the family's pickup truck. The family was fleeing fierce fighting in Nasiriyah. U.S. Central Command said it's investigating the report. The London Independent is reporting a U.S. missile was confirmed yesterday as the cause of the explosion at a Baghdad market in the Shuala district on Friday night that killed at least 62 Iraqis. Journalist Robert Fisk took down the remains of the missile's serial number, and the Independent has now confirmed the weapon was manufactured in Texas by Raytheon. Both the U.S. and Britain have suggested that Shuala bombing was caused by aging Iraqi anti-aircraft missiles. The Pentagon and Raytheon declined to comment on the serial number evidence last night. Raytheon is the world's biggest producer of so-called smart bombs and had nearly $17 billion in sales last year. The chair of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, yesterday expressed, quote, regrets to the families of the Iraqis killed yesterday at the checkpoint near Najaf. But then he blamed the Iraqis, adding, quote, the climate established by the Iraqi regime contributed to this incident. At least 7 Iraqi women and children were killed when U.S. troops fired into the passenger cabin of their van at the checkpoint. We have this report today from Knight Ridder newspapers. Iraqi family thought they were fleeing to safety. It says near Najaf, Iraq. An Iraqi family who lost 11 members when U.S. soldiers opened fire as their sport utility vehicle approached a checkpoint Monday were fleeing toward U.S. lines because they thought a leaflet dropped by American helicopters told them to, quote, be safe. And that meant getting out of their village to Karbala, this according to a survivor. Bakat Hassan, who lost his daughters, aged 2 and 5, his son, 3, his parents, 2 older brothers, their wives, and 2 nieces, aged 12 and 15, said American soldiers at an earlier checkpoint had waved them through as they drove away from their home village. As they approached another checkpoint, 25 miles south of Karbala, they waved again at the American soldiers. "We were thinking these Americans want us to be safe," Hassan said through an army translator at a mobile army surgical hospital set up at a vast army support camp near Najaf. The soldiers didn't wave, they fired. "I saw the heads of my 2 little girls come off," Hassan's wife recalled numbly. She repeated herself in a flat, even voice, "My girls, I watched their heads come off their bodies. My son is dead." U.S. officials originally gave the death toll as 7, and reporters at the scene placed it at 10. But Hassan's father died at the Army hospital later. The details that emerge in interviews with the survivors of Monday's incident tell a distressing tale of a family fleeing toward what they thought would be safety. Hassan's father in his 60s wore his best clothes for the trip through the American lines, a pinstripe suit. "To look American," Hassan said. "A miscommunication with civilians," said an Army report written on Monday night. Today, U.S. Marines shot dead another unarmed driver and badly wounded his passenger at a roadblock in the southern town of Shatra, south of Baghdad. To the east of the capital, U.S. Marines say they've seized a key bridge across the River Tigris at the city of Kut. This would allow them to take control of one of the main highways north towards Baghdad. Air forces continued to bomb Baghdad heavily. President Bush has given the green light to U.S. Commander Tommy Franks to launch the battle for Baghdad. The London Guardian reports the Pentagon disclosed the move in an effort to dispel fears that the invasion has become bogged down. Meanwhile, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Richard Myers claimed U.S. bombing has reduced the fighting capability of the Republican Guard's Medina Division by more than half. Meanwhile, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein issued a new statement today. He declared that victory is at hand and urged Iraqis to fight on and defend their towns. Today's statement was read by an Iraqi news anchor in a military uniform and broadcast on Iraqi satellite television. Newsday journalist Matthew McAllister and photographer Moises Saman were released by Iraqi authorities yesterday. They'd been missing for 8 days. The journalists were detained by Iraqi intelligence agents who apparently believed they were spies. They were held at the Abu Ghraib prison. They were imprisoned, interrogated. The two said they were never mistreated or abused physically while in custody, but they said they heard the screams of other prisoners they believe were being tortured. It appears the journalists may owe their freedom to Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Moises Saman has relatives living in the West Bank. Former U.S. Consul General Ed Abington, who is now an advisor to the Palestinian Authority, spoke twice with Arafat about the journalists. Arafat agreed to try to free them. He then instructed one of his former ambassadors to Iraq to contact the head of Iraqi military intelligence, who then ordered their release. McAllister is a 33-year-old reporter, and Moises Saman, 29-year-old photographer, were released and made it to Amman, Jordan. They were released along with 2 other reporters, one a photographer, a former photographer for Al Gore. U.S. Marines have rescued Private Jessica Lynch, who is being held prisoner by Iraqi troops. Private Lynch was one of 15 soldiers listed missing, captured, or killed when a maintenance company convoy made a wrong turn and came under attack from Iraqi tanks and fighters. A military spokesman said today 11 bodies were found with Lynch in the commando raid on an Iraqi hospital. Some of them are believed to be Americans. 19-year-old Lynch joined the Army to get an education. She left a farming community in Palestine, West Virginia, with an unemployment rate of 15%. The New York Daily News reports the U.S. military has come up with a solution for the penniless people of Umkasar who are begging for water. Sell it. Despite general mayhem at distribution points, including knife fights, the Army has struck a hasty agreement with local Iraqis to expedite water distribution. Under the deal, the military will provide water free to locals with access to tanker trucks, who then will be allowed to sell the water for a, quote, reasonable fee. Army Colonel David Bassert said, quote, this provides them with an incentive to hustle and to work. The U.S. military has authorized troops to detain Iraqi civilians who, quote, interfere with mission accomplishment. Under the new guidelines, suspects can be treated similarly to POWs and held for up to 30 days. A group of Yemeni volunteers in Iraq vowed today to launch suicide attacks against invading U.S. and British troops. Reuters reports a group of 35 Yemenis in military uniform marched to the Palestine Hotel in central Baghdad, where foreign journalists are staying. The BBC reports the Iraqi embassy in Algiers is being inundated with inquiries from young Algerians who want to fight against the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And Syria announced it's chosen to support the Iraqi people against the illegal invasion of Iraq. The announcement follows a new warning by Secretary of State General Colin Powell, who told Syria now faces a, quote, critical choice. And a new poll by the French newspaper Le Monde has found that one-third of the French people desire an Iraqi victory over U.S. and British forces. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Jeremy Scahill, just recently back from Baghdad.
Good day, Amy, and to everyone around the country.
Well, I'm going to take a quick read of a letter that was written to Colin Powell. Dear Mr. Secretary, I'm writing you to submit my resignation from the Foreign Service of the United States and from my position as political counselor in the U.S. Embassy Athens, effective March 7th. I do so with a heavy heart. The baggage of my upbringing included a felt obligation to give something back to my country. Service as a U.S. diplomat was a dream job. I was paid to understand foreign languages and cultures, to seek out diplomats, politicians, scholars, and journalists, and to persuade them that U.S. interests and theirs fundamentally coincided. My faith in my country and its values was the most powerful weapon in my diplomatic arsenal. So begins a letter from career diplomat John Brady Keesling to Secretary of State General Colin Powell. We are joined right now on the telephone by John Brady Keesling, 19-year Foreign Service veteran who resigned over the Bush administration's handling of Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's very good to have you with us. Well, can you talk further about your decision to resign?
Well, the fundamental element of my decision, though obviously there were personal considerations that went into it as well, was the conviction that the war that we were about to wage in Iraq would have an effect opposite to the effect we wanted from it. We were going to make the American people less safe, not more safe. We were going to alienate not just the Middle East, which we had already alienated, but also a great mass of European friends and allies who until now had believed that we were still basically a force for stability, peace, prosperity, and even good in the world. And maybe I'm a stupid idealist, but I believe that when you convince your old friends that you're not a force for good in the world, you're doing a very dangerous thing to your own interests.
And what was the final straw for you in deciding to resign? Did you attempt first to convey your views in another way? Did you get a chance to speak with Colin Powell?
No. I never saw Colin Powell as really the problem. I started out at one point back in the beginning of September, as it became clear that we had made some decision for war, to write a letter or write a cable in our dissent channel saying, look, this war is not going to do what we want it to. You know, for these reasons, we should think again. I put that dissent channel message aside when we decided to go to the United Nations. I thought the United Nations process would, or I hoped that it would tell us that we couldn't do it, that it was too expensive, that no one agreed with us, and that we'd put it on the shelf in favor of improved sanctions. And I held out that faint hope for a long time because, in fact, by our very, very tough policy, we persuaded the United Nations Security Council to rally around a really sweeping and probably effective inspections regime, which over time would have done what we needed to if weapons of mass destruction really were the problem. But as it became clear in late January, in the beginning of February, that we were not going to turn back, and as it became clear, it was just obvious to me that the war could not possibly go well. I mean, we could win it militarily, but we would have to do so much collateral damage, not only to the innocent people of Iraq and the not-so-innocent people of Iraq, but to our sensibilities around the world, that it was just clear that we were asking the military to do something that no military could achieve, which was a clean, painless, politically sound shift of the government there.
There was a Wall Street Journal profiling of you yesterday after resigning to protest war diplomat turns peace envoy. And it quotes former State Department Inspector General and retired ambassador William Harrop as saying, I certainly don't take exception to his resignation, but I would draw the line at promoting public opinion against the government or the war. He said, I believe it's a seriously wrong decision to invade Iraq, but it isn't appropriate to agitate as a former government official. Your response?
My response is that America's interests transcend the... I clearly do have reservations about what I'm doing. No Foreign Service officer can instantly make a transition from being a loyal and very disciplined supporter of a policy over 20 years to suddenly becoming a wild-eyed radical, speaking out against government policy. But... it was clear to me that our interests, America's interests, are still in very serious danger. The United States has begun to learn at least one of the lessons from its mistakes, but it's not at all clear that we really still get it. We're about to come up against one of the most painful political decisions that will have been taken since Hiroshima. When we have invested Baghdad, when the city is surrounded, we will militarily take the Iraqi military apart. There's no question about that. But then we have the question of whether we attack Baghdad. If Baghdad resists, the result will be disastrous. I mean, in 1258, the Mongols destroyed Baghdad, and the Arabs still remember that. I pray to God that we do not put ourselves in that position. I mean, it could be that a way will be found to either have Saddam you know, assassinated or put aside, or else to have him leave quietly. But if the United States is forced to grind in with overwhelming military force into Baghdad, the costs to America will be paid not just for months or years, but for generations.
Finally, the response of your fellow diplomats. What kind of furor has there been within the diplomatic corps as a result of, it's not just your resignation. Your resignation, I think, gave courage to at least two other people resigning.
Yeah, well, the feeling in the State Department is that the State Department has been marginalized. This administration made the decision to go to war without actually talking to anyone who knew something serious about the Middle East, I think. Or this is an administration that is really good making it its own mind up, and if you don't agree with them, they freeze you out. Those people who did disagree sort of got frozen out and became irrelevant. Others were forced, as I think Colin Powell was forced, to adapt their position to the orthodoxy of the president and the Secretary of Defense. Once there's this kind of orthodoxy where it's impossible to, you know, to say yes, sir, but this is not going to work, people just go limp. And I think a lot of the Foreign Service right now is sitting back, sort of mechanically doing what they must do, but they've been taken out of this process. I got a lot of good personal support from colleagues, many of whom were not comfortable with the extreme to which my logic had taken me, but respected sort of the purity of my intentions, and they themselves are sort of bewailing what's happened. Well, the collateral damage has already been to our relationships and our interests in Europe and elsewhere. So I don't know. I think the State Department is right now sort of in this watching and waiting mood, aware that very soon it will have to step into action to try to repair the damage. And I think a lot of people are sort of holding their, you know, saving up their ammunition for that.
Well, John Brady Kiesling, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Well,
John,
you're very welcome.
Thank you. 19-year Foreign Service veteran who resigned over the invasion of Iraq. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, an American returns from Baghdad and describes civilian casualties, something that we don't see very much in the news, Iraqi casualties. Stay with us.
I was born by the river in a little tent, oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. It's been but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know brother.
You are listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Well, the news today is horrifying. In the farming town of Hilla, the local hospital director said 33 people were killed and more than 300 wounded in a bombing raid yesterday. The London Guardian reports unedited TV footage from the Babylon Hospital showed horrifically injured bodies heaped into pickup trucks. Relatives of the dead accompanied them for burial. Bed after bed of injured women and children were pictured along with large pools of blood on the floor of the hospital. An AFP reporter encountered a civilian sitting among 15 coffins at the Babylon Hospital. Razak Al-Kazam Al-Kafaji said the coffins contained the bodies of his wife, six children, his father, his mother, his three brothers, and their wives. They were killed Monday night when the U.S. helicopter gunship fired on the family's pickup truck. The family was fleeing fierce fighting in Nasiriyah. U.S. Central Command said it's investigating the report. Meanwhile, U.S. peace activists have provided the first confirmation that the hospital in the western town of Rutba has been destroyed by bombs. The Associated Press is reporting that as the Iraq peace team members approached a doctor demanded, why did you Americans bomb a children's hospital? The activists said they saw no significant Iraqi military presence near the hospital or elsewhere in Rutba. U.S. Central Command claimed Sunday it has no knowledge of the incident. Cliff Kindy is in the studio with us, a member of the Iraq peace team and Christian peacemaker team recently expelled from Iraq. You were a part of that group in Rutba who saw the hospital.
Yes, we came out from Baghdad on Saturday morning, leaving at 9, pulled into Amman about 3 o'clock Sunday morning.
Now, this is a broadcast on television around the country and on radio, so people who are listening can't see your head that's bandaged. What happened?
We had just passed the bridge around Rutba, sort of a bypass road. It had been bombed earlier. There was still a burned-out bus on our lane. Half the lane was sort of swaying. It was sloped to the center, but we passed the bus, went on around. Perhaps at that point we had picked up some kind of shrapnel in the tire. It was a couple kilometers down the road. The left rear tire blew on our small taxi, one of three vehicles in a caravan that was going out of Baghdad. We skidded into the ditch, kind of careened down the ditch, and then at the far end dropped into a hole, maybe at 10 miles an hour, slammed into the far wall and turned on our side. The five of us inside were injured. As we were clambering out, a pickup truck across the road in the other lane stopped for us, came and helped us get in. It was pretty tight, so they stopped another station wagon, and the station wagon took us on into Rutba, five, ten minute drive from where we had our accident. But at that point, there was a jet fighter in the air. They were worried we were going to get shot on the road, so somebody was frantically waving a white towel. We came into Rutba. We were taken to a primary health care clinic in the town. It was just shortly afterward we understood that the children's hospital in Rutba had been bombed just 3 days earlier. In spite of that, the medical personnel there said, doesn't matter whether you're Iraqi or American, Muslim or Christian, we take care of everybody. Welcome, welcome. And they put us on beds. They had Weldon quickly hooked up to an IV. He had back trouble, had some injuries. He now has today got out of the hospital in Amman with a cracked clavicle, cracked collarbone, two cracked ribs and broken thumb, but he's doing okay. Two others of us were injured. I was had the split across the top of my head, apparently from hitting the roof of the car, and they put 10 stitches in my head to keep it from bleeding so badly. And we went on from there then and arrived at the border and then on into Amman.
Since the Army is refuting this, saying they have no knowledge of the incident of the hospital, right, can you explain exactly what this hospital was, who it was for, and what you saw?
Okay. Keep in mind that our attention was on the blood that was dripping all over me and the rest of our members. There were two of our group, two Japanese journalists, who did take photos of that hospital, and those are available for people who are interested to confirm what it looks like. It was a small area behind sort of a compound. It had been flattened, seemingly from the air. It looked like it had caved in. It was reported to be a children's hospital. We did not pursue how many people were injured or killed or anything like that, because we were rushing to get ourselves cared for. The journalists may have more information on that. They're now in Japan right now.
Cliff, we can't see under your bandage, but when the doctors treated you, did they use anesthetics?
No, they did not. But I survived. The worst part was a day later when the hospital in Amman used an injection painkiller to put 3 more stitches in. That was worse than the 10 stitches earlier.
Why is it that you were leaving Iraq in the first place? I mean, we understand you were expelled, but what happened? Why? You were there in solidarity with people in Iraq. What happened?
It was Friday morning, just before 7 o'clock. There were 2 huge explosions right near the Al-Dar Hotel where 8 of us were staying. I was quickly on the street, saw an ambulance approaching that area. It would have been about 5 or 6 blocks from where we were staying, and then another emergency vehicle. We tried to call out, but of course our phone lines were down that day. That was one of the things. It was clear that there was an attempt to cut off communication links, whether it was the email lines or the telephone lines, maybe because people were effective in getting an alternative picture out. But that morning we couldn't get a taxi, so we'd walked together to a meeting at the Al-Fanar Hotel and passed within a few blocks of the communication center that had been taken out. We were invited by an officer on the street to welcome to head that direction. We were a bit cautious about that because we know we need to have somebody be with us in those kinds of visits. But we visited a restaurant hotel across the street where they invited us in to take pictures of the glass that had blown out. We could see the other hotel kind of catty-corner and down the street. And because of that, I think it was assumed by police, who then quickly confronted us about our being there, that we had taken pictures of that. We hadn't, but still they had those questions. We were taken to a police station, held for 4.5 hours that day, not questioned or anything, but held until our government contact reached us. His home had...
This was Iraqi government.
The Iraqi government. The house next to his that night had been bombed, so his house had lost all its windows with his wife and child in. He was really uptight. Some others in the group had been missing because of an attempt to reach Najaf the day before. Another member of our team had been all night in the Palestine Hotel using the sat phone, unbeknownst to our contact. So, and also that night, stricter guidelines had been set down, allowing and not allowing internationals on the street in certain situations, certain times, and all of that came together, and we kind of became the fall guys. 8 of us were kicked out then the next day.
Going back to the hospital,
yes.
What did the doctor say? The reports we got, Associated Press, asking why did you Americans bomb our children's hospital? What further did he say to you?
I think it was incredulous to him that U.S. forces would target a hospital. I mean, they were clear that they were willing to treat even Americans. This was 3 days later. Why would anybody target a hospital?
Did he talk about casualties at all?
No, he did not talk. Mm-hmm. He did mention to Shane something about 2 people dead. It wasn't clear to Shane whether that was in the hospital or what, and so I'm not...
Have you gotten a chance yet to talk to authorities now that you're here about the bombing of the hospital?
When we got to Amman, it was reported in the news conference the next day to the United Nations about our observing that. And because of that, many media did approach us and ask for interviews. We have not talked with government authorities about that, and they have not approached us.
What Rutba is a place that journalists have not traveled to. It's very near to the Iraqi border with Jordan. What else did the city look like? How devastated was it? No one's been in there.
Well, one of our group had come out a few days earlier. He had heard about conflict there in Rutba. Another of our delegations had come back in right on the heels of his exit, and then we were there 3 days later. It's clear that there was fighting going on in there. The customs house had been bombed. We saw that clearly. There was a communication center that had been bombed, also electrical center of some kind that had been bombed. We were not on... It's a town, according to the doctor, of about 20,000 people, or that municipal area. and we were not in much of it, but the area where we came in and out, we did see those things that I just mentioned to you. And other than that, I can't speak with a whole lot of experience on what was happening there.
Why did you go to Iraq?
I went to Iraq because I thought it was still possible to stop a war for a change, that we didn't have to just wait for a war to happen and watch it take place, that in fact we could stop it. And I think to a large extent we were very successful. The efforts around the world to stand against that war, whether those were religious leaders, whether those were popular movements, whether those were the movements in the United Nations, whether those were actions of former diplomats or even military officials, it was very clear that there was not support globally for a war in Iraq. The madness is that an insanity invades political leadership that does have the ability to control the movement of military forces, and they can make the decision that the way to relate with other human beings is with a bomb. That's an insanity that overcomes even the magnificent efforts of the people worldwide to stop a war.
Well, Cliff Kendi, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Cliff Kendi of the Iraq Peace Team and Christian Peacemaker Team has just made it out of Iraq. He was expelled from Iraq and went through Rutba, where he heard about the hospital bombing. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move on to a major story that is a development in this country, then we're going to talk about media coverage of what has gone on in Iraq. Remember the story of Tulia, Texas, where in 1999 more than 15% of the town's African-American population was rounded up in a massive drug sweep. In all, 46 people were arrested, 39 of them African-American. They were jailed on cocaine and crack charges. One undercover detective, who was white, made all the arrests, provided all the evidence, none of which could be corroborated. Stiff, harsh sentences were handed down. One man was sentenced to 99 years in prison. 13 of the Tulia residents remain in prison despite international protests over the sweep. While a handful of cases already had been dismissed, now looks like the remaining cases will be overturned. Yesterday, a Texas judge agreed with the prosecutor's defense lawyers that the court should vacate 38 convictions arising from the drug sting, including those in which the defendants pleaded guilty. Jeff Blackburn is on the line with us, who is with the Tulia Legal Defense Project. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us what happened?
Well, it was a big reversal of fortune for all of these folks that are locked up, the people that were convicted as a result of this, and certainly all their families. It was a sweeping victory for us on the defense team who've been working for this, and for other people who've been putting together a movement around our legal efforts, especially Randy Credico from the Kunstler Fund, who was down here working with us and who had brought this story to the attention of the world in the beginning. Essentially, what's gone on legally is the first step towards getting an ultimate reversal. It has to be approved by the Court of Criminal Appeals. But the trial judge that was assigned to us, a judge named Ron Chapman, essentially agreed with us, but gave us more than we ever hoped that we would get in releasing and ordering the release and beginning the process of releasing all of the people that were arrested as a result of this cop.
We're also joined by Maddie White, the mother of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar White, who was sentenced to 60 years for selling cocaine to an undercover agent. Again, one of more than 40 African-Americans arrested by the same agent, Tom Coleman, after an 18-month undercover operation. Maddie White, altogether, four of your children were arrested? Four?
Yes.
Huh. By Tom Coleman?
Yes.
And what did he say about them all?
What did he say?
Yes.
He said they all sold him powder cocaine.
And right now, one of your sons remains in jail.
Yes, and one of my daughters.
And one of your daughters.
Uh-huh.
And so your thoughts today, with the Texas judge agreeing to throw out the 38 convictions arising from the sting, which includes Presumably both of your children?
Yes.
How are you feeling?
All I can just say is God is good. You know, that's all I've been saying. I prayed last night, and I knew that he was going to do something for us. I just didn't have no doubt.
Have you talked to your kids in jail?
No. My daughter called me the day before, and she knew that we was going to have the trial, but she don't. I don't guess she know unless she done saw it on the news.
Jeff Blackburn, can you describe who Tom Coleman is and how what happened in this trial that was held earlier this week?
It's hard to do briefly because Coleman is an extraordinary character. He's got to be a liar of biblical proportions. I don't think any of us in the courtroom, and certainly none of us who worked on this case and knew from his trial testimony in different cases and had reviewed all the transcripts and all the information that we put together, could have ever imagined that anyone would be capable of this much perjury and this much fabrication of evidence. Coleman was a gypsy cop hired on, as they like to put it, to do a job which he done by the local regional narcotics task force. In many ways, Coleman, although he's not a sympathetic character, presents a situation that that gives you a little pause to think, because Coleman himself, in our view, was a pawn, a nobody who had not done well. He'd been fired from every police agency he'd ever worked in, who was completely on the skids and down to his very, very last chance. Took the chance given him by the Panhandle Regional Narcotics Trafficking Task Force, as they call themselves, and made good on it as far as they were concerned because he produced numbers. It's all about numbers for them, and it was all about numbers for Tom Coleman. And those numbers took him from a zero in law enforcement in Texas to a major hero. At the end of this thing, he found himself getting plaques and awards. He was named a Texas Law Enforcement Officer of the Year. So he is a classic example of the kind of cops that they get to do this kind of work and the kind of cops that get rewarded for doing it. He was very good at what they wanted him to do, namely hoking up testimony that could put people behind bars. He simply made up a lot of the cases. Many of these people were innocent, and given the way the system works here, they were given lousy lawyers provided for them by the court who did no work, did nothing, essentially, to defend them. And the result was the system just ground its way on and sent them to prison for ridiculous terms, 90 years, 75 years, 45, on and on and on. Coleman is a kind of a proletarian cop, a two-bit pawn in a much bigger game that I am convinced to this day, even from his testimony from last week, still doesn't really understand why anybody's critical of him. I mean, he did his job, which was to get numbers and put away bad people. That's kind of an expression we use for black people in Tulia, bad people, and still can't understand what all the furor is about.
Finally, we're joined by Randy Credico, director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Randy, when you heard about this piece, you never stopped. You went down to Tulia. You worked with people, organizing folks. Your response to the judge's decision yesterday?
Well, I'm very happy. And I'm very happy that that they had, first of all, to have Jeff Blackburn, who's been working from day one. And 3 years ago when we came down here, Emily Sarah Kunstler and I came down here. Town is a lot different now. When these guys get out, I'm happy that they're getting out and that they will get out. But, it's 3 years later. They're not going to notice this city. This city has changed dramatically in the last 3 years. Many of the black residents have left. Other people have kind of thrown in the towel because there's no work here. It's a real mess. And when they get back, like Joe Moore, who's going to be 62 years old, he's got diabetes. He should have been out, severe diabetes. He should have been out 3 years ago. He should have never gone to prison. So he's coming out. I mean, it's a bittersweet victory that took this long. And, you know, it would have never happened if it weren't for this great legal group that came down here that Jeff put together. I'm elated that they are getting out. And the thing is, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what goes on in this state. You can find these kinds of operations throughout Texas, sponsored by these regional narcotics task forces. And like we've gotten, the Concert Fund have gotten millions of letters from people around the state who are in prison suffering the same kind of consequences that these 46 defendants have suffered.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Randy Credico, William Moses Concert Fund for Racial Justice. Maddie White, mother of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar White, sentenced to 60 years for selling cocaine to the undercover agent Tom Coleman, who basically himself is on trial now. And Jeff Blackburn of the Tulia Legal Defense Project. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at media coverage, civilian casualties. Norman Solomon joins us. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Sweet Honey in the Rock. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill. The father of a U.S. Marine blamed George Bush for his son's death. I'm reading from the Daily Mirror of Britain. Fernando Suarez de Solar said U.S. officials had refused to give his family any details on how 20-year-old Lance Corporal Jesus died, other than it was at Nasiriya. The father said, President Bush hasn't shown that this war is necessary. He has shown that this war is for the U.S. to have the oil. Fernando moved his family to California from Mexico 6 years ago. He added, this never would have happened if I didn't come to this country. We're joined right now by Norman Solomon, who is a media critic. On the one hand, we have stories like these that don't get very much attention, very difficult to find. And on the other hand, also, civilian casualties in Iraq get almost no attention. In fact, the numbers very carefully documented for U.S. soldiers. But in today's New York Times, in an article titled U.S. Military Has No Count of Iraqi Dead in Fighting, it's John Broder starts, the world knows with some precision how many American and British soldiers have been killed so far in the war in Iraq, 73 as of late today. The names of the dead and the cause of their deaths are scrupulously reported by Washington and London with some delay to notify their families. But how many Iraqi soldiers have died? It could be scores, hundreds, even thousands. No one outside Iraq and probably no one there either knows. As in the Persian Gulf War in 91 and in Afghanistan, the American military is not counting. Norman Solomon is author of Target Iraq with Reese Ehrlich. Can you talk about the stories we hear, the numbers that count, and the numbers that don't count?
This is about who counts and who counts. 24 hours ago, the BBC was reporting between 500 and 700 Iraqi civilians already killed by what's called the coalition forces. Certainly the numbers have risen since then. And as the much-hyped battle for Baghdad gets underway, we're looking at thousands and thousands of predictable, anticipatable civilian deaths because of the Pentagon's war on Iraq. I think that you need look no farther than the lead editorial of the New York Times today, this supposedly dovish newspaper, editorializing, and I quote, "The war appears to have gone fairly well so far on the ground, pretty well for them at their suites in New York City." And also, I think quite tellingly, the New York Times editorializing that, in their words, the great challenge of Iraq is less about winning the war than about securing the peace, unquote. In the context of a guerrilla war, an impending occupation, it appears, what does it mean to talk about securing the peace? It talks about, really, below the surface of the words, what was called pacification during the Vietnam War, a continued occupation and, frankly, slaughter of Iraqi civilians.
Norman Solomon, you've been writing extensively about this. I haven't seen you a little bit. I saw you before the invasion of Iraq on places like CNN, but I haven't seen you there recently.
Well, I think my experience has probably been very similar to yours, and certainly others opposed to this war who, for whatever combination of reasons, have been invited onto mainstream media outlets. I was on CNN five or six times in the weeks running up to the beginning of the war. I've not gotten any invitations since then. The small amount of space that did exist in the mass media, I think, for substantive dissent has been largely closed, at least for now. If you look at, for instance, the op-ed page of the New York Times today, I think you see part of why. There's a essay by a former Marine Corps general. Then there's another essay by a former Air Force chief of staff. Then there's Maureen Dowd reprising for the umpteenth time her theories of Oedipal conflict between the two presidents, Bush, and then for good measure, Thomas Friedman from Cairo evidently can't find the space to talk about U.S. subsidized torture by the Egyptian regime, but praising in his column today how America, quote, has finally used its revolutionary power in the Arab world, unquote, for good. That's what dominates what passes for debate and critique in the U.S. mass media.
There also, Norman, was this report in The Guardian a few days ago, The Guardian of London, saying that the BBC had become so concerned at the false and misleading information that was being put out in the war by Pentagon officials that they're rethinking their strategy on how to deal with their journalists who are embedded with U.S. forces.
Yeah, during my visits to Baghdad, I dealt with a lot of BBC reporters and, of course, watch BBC television and listen to the World Service of the BBC. The Atlantic Ocean has never seemed wider. The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer or All Things Considered or Morning Edition are really engaged in what we could call disinfotainment compared to the decent journalism that we often get from the BBC. And I think, again, this goes to the ideology that has been internalized by the U.S. mass media. Going back to today's New York Times editorial, this is a very telling quote. "The fear of terrorists disguised as civilians has soured military relations with Iraqis," unquote. When the New York Times says that the U.S. military is encountering Iraqi terrorists inside Iraq, we see the prefiguring of the mentality of brutal occupation, one familiar to Palestinians who are dealing with the Israeli occupiers, the notion that as you occupy other people's lands and engage in ethnic cleansing and brutal attacks, you are, when you encounter resistance, you are encountering terrorism. This stands on its head, I think, the reality, and I don't hesitate to say, just based on the evidence we have, that the U.S. agency called the Department of Defense is operating in Iraq today as a massive terrorist organization. That is a taboo analysis in U.S. news media.
I wanted to get your response to what happened with Peter Arnett. Now, General Bahari McCaffrey, who Seymour Hersh exposed in The New Yorker several years ago as having his unit fire on fleeing Iraqis, remains at MSNBC and NBC on their payroll as a commentator. But Peter Arnett has been fired. They say he was fired for comments he made to Iraqi television. Let's take a listen, if we can. We have heard what Peter Arnett says. If we don't have the tape available, Peter Arnett's comments, where he said the United States had misjudged, and that the Iraqi resistance. Your comments on that?
Well, that's not different than what many U.S. ex-military and present military people have said, sometimes on background. But Peter Arnett, I think, as far as the U.S. Government is concerned, and some at General Electric, which owns NBC and MSNBC, they felt that he had an attitude problem, that he was too inclined to be, I believe, even-handed. And then I think we could say that Arnett perhaps overly fatigued and willing to go the extra distance to keep his position in place in Baghdad, maybe sucked up a little bit to the Iraqi authorities, but nothing compared to the incessant suck-up by hundreds and hundreds of U.S. journalists to Central Command, to the White House, to the State Department, to the Pentagon. That's okay, according to the media powers that be, if you're going to serve as basically a mouthpiece for U.S. war makers. But if you don't stay on that track, you are suspect as far as the media industrial military complex is concerned.
Okay, let's take a listen to what Peter Arnett had to say.
In the United States, is growing challenge to President Bush about the conduct of the war and also opposition to the war. So our reports about civilian casualties here, about the resistance of the Iraqi forces, are going back to the United States. It helps those who oppose the war and who challenge the policy to develop their arguments. And the first war plan has failed. Now they're trying to write another war plan.
That was Peter Arnett.
There's no doubt that he stepped out of line, out of the tacitly understood role of U.S. journalists, which really at this point is to help numb the American public. All you got to do is watch the TV coverage, the kind of jingo narcissism, the anesthetic role, so that we will hide from ourselves, in a sense, as Americans, for instance, that in our names, with our tax dollars, so many people are being slaughtered, and for what reason? A totally deceptive rationale for this war in the first place.
Well, Norman Solomon, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Norman Solomon's book is called Target Iraq with Reese Ehrlich. It's published by Context Books. Whether or not you're seen a lot on mainstream television, your book is certainly going through a lot of printings.
It is. Thanks, Amy.
And it really does indicate that people want something different. Also, I encourage people to look at Robert Jensen's piece in today's Newsday. Arnett paid a price for being neutral. Arnett was canned, he says, because he took seriously the notion that even in war, journalists should be neutral. You're listening to Democracy Now!, which is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Special thanks to Jenny DeFilippazzo. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. And you can get a copy of today's show by calling 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening.
Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now.
I think the mere fact of underrepresentation, that is that, say, blacks are not represented as they are in the population, is not a concern that would justify racial preferences. It certainly would justify perhaps broad social and political concerns.
Well, it's a broad social and political concern that they're not adequate members of a profession.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard opening arguments in two landmark cases that may decide the future of affirmative action. We'll have our own debate today. Attorney Kirk Colbo joins us a day after he argued against affirmative action before the Supreme Court, and Miranda Massey, lead attorney for the University of Michigan students who backed the preservation of affirmative action. And we'll talk to Sholene Espinoza, an embedded reporter who's just returned from Iraq.
Well, I was with the 1st Tank Battalion, United States Marine Corps, leaving the other day. They asked me to bring a message back to America with regard to how this war is progressing and some of the surprises that they've seen in terms of needing a different tack in terms of being able to successfully achieve the U.S. objectives.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. forces have begun a major attack against Iraqi Republican Guard divisions surrounding the Iraqi capital. The Associated Press reports B-52 bombers carpet-bombed Karbala throughout the night. 3rd Infantry units surge past the strategic city without entering it. In the nearby farming town of Hilla, the local hospital director said 33 people were killed and more than 300 wounded in a bombing raid yesterday. A spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross told the Agence France-Presse, quote, there were dozens of smashed corpses at the hospital. The London Guardian reports unedited TV footage from the Babylon Hospital showed horrifically injured bodies heaped into pickup trucks. Relatives of the dead accompanied them for burial. Bed after bed of injured women and children were pictured along with large pools of blood on the floor of the hospital. An Edinburgh-trained doctor at the hospital, Nazim Al-Adali, told The Guardian, all of these are due to the American bombing to the civilian homes. He said there were not any army vehicles or tanks in the area. One stunned man who lost his whole family said, God take our revenge on America. An AFP reporter saw what appeared to be the component devices for cluster bombs covering a large area in the town. This comes as the Washington Post reports today U.S. military commanders have shed their early caution in striking some targets in Baghdad and have embarked on more aggressive air attacks that run the risk of larger numbers of civilian casualties. The change in tactics appear to reflect a judgment that winning the war against Iraq will require more aggressive air attacks. An AFP reporter also encountered a civilian sitting among 15 coffins at the Babylon Hospital. Razek El-Khazem Al-Kafaji said the coffins contained the bodies of his wife, 6 children, his father, his mother, his 3 brothers, and their wives. They were killed Monday night when a U.S. helicopter gunship fired on the family's pickup truck. The family was fleeing fierce fighting in Nasiriyah. U.S. Central Command said it is investigating the report. And a survivor of the Iraqi family who lost 11 members when U.S. soldiers opened fire on their vehicle at a checkpoint near Najaf said his family was fleeing toward U.S. lines because they thought a leaflet dropped by U.S. helicopters suggested they do so. This according to an article in Knight Ridder. Bakat Hassan lost his daughters, ages 2 and 5, his son, 3, his parents, 2 older brothers, their wives, and 2 nieces, aged 12 and 15. Hassan's wife, Lamea, recalled, quote, I saw the heads of my 2 little girls come off. She repeated herself in a flat, even voice. My girls, I watched their heads come off their bodies. My son is dead. The Hassan family fled from Karbala, which has come under heavy U.S. bombing. Helicopters dropped leaflets on the town. A drawing of a family sitting at a table, eating and smiling, with a message written in Arabic. Sergeant First Class Stephen Furbish said the message read, quote, "To be safe, stay put." But Hassan said he and his father thought it just said, "Be safe." To them, that meant getting away from the helicopters firing rockets and missiles. The family of 17 packed into its 1974 Land Rover so crowded that Bakat, who was hanging on the back door outside the rear bumper, everyone else was piled on one another's laps in three sets of seats. Hassan said U.S. soldiers at an earlier checkpoint had waved them through as they drove away from their home village. As they approached another checkpoint, they waved again at the U.S. soldiers. Hassan said through an army translator, "We were thinking these Americans want us to be safe." The soldiers didn't wave back. They fired. Hassan's father in his 60s wore his best clothes for the trip through the American lines, a pinstripe suit. Hassan said he wanted to look American, but Hassan's father died at the army hospital later, bringing the death toll to 11. Navy Captain Frank Thorpe said initial reports indicate the soldiers at the checkpoint had acted properly. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, yesterday expressed regrets to the families of the dead Iraqis, but then he blamed the Iraqis, adding, quote, "The climate established by the Iraqi regime contributed to this incident." U.S. Marines today shot dead another unarmed driver and badly wounded his passenger at a roadblock in the southern town of Shatra, south of Baghdad. The London Independent is reporting a U.S. missile was confirmed yesterday as the cause of the explosion at a Baghdad market in the Shuali district on Friday night that killed at least 62 Iraqis. Journalist Robert Fisk took down the remains of the missile's serial number, and the Independent has now confirmed the weapon was manufactured in Texas by Raytheon. Both the U.S. and Britain have suggested the Shuali bombing was caused by aging Iraqi anti-aircraft missiles. The Pentagon and Raytheon declined to comment on the serial number evidence last night. Raytheon is the world's biggest producer of so-called smart bombs and had nearly $17 billion in sales last year. To the east of the capital, U.S. Marines say they've seized a key bridge across the River Tigris at the city of Kut. This would allow them to take control of one of the main highways north of Baghdad. Air forces continue to bomb Baghdad heavily. President Bush has given the green light to U.S. Commander Tommy Franks to launch the battle for Baghdad. The London Guardian reports the Pentagon disclosed the move in an effort to dispel fears that the invasion has become bogged down. Meanwhile, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Richard Myers claimed U.S. bombing has reduced the fighting capability of the Republican Guard's Medina Division by more than half. Meanwhile, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein issued a new statement today. He declared that victory is at hand and argued Iraqis to fight on and defend their towns. Today's statement was read by an Iraqi news anchor in a military uniform and broadcast on Iraqi satellite television. Newsday reporters Matthew McAllister and photographer Moises Salmon were released by Iraqi authorities yesterday. They'd been missing for 8 days. The journalist and photographer were detained by Iraqi intelligence agents who apparently believed they were spies. They were imprisoned and interrogated. The two said they were never mistreated or abused physically while in custody at Al Ghuraib prison, but said they heard the screams of other prisoners they believed were being tortured. It appears the journalists may owe their freedom to Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Moises Salmon has relatives who live in the West Bank. Former U.S. Consul General Ed Abington, who is now an advisor to the Palestinian Authority, spoke twice with Arafat about the journalists. Arafat agreed to try to free them. He then instructed one of his former ambassadors to Iraq to contact the head of Iraqi military intelligence, who then ordered their release. Two other reporter photographers were also released with them and made it over the border into Amman. Molly Bingham, who is the private photographer for Al Gore, as well as a Danish journalist. U.S. Marines have rescued Private Jessica Lynch, who is being held prisoner by Iraqi troops. Private Lynch was one of 15 soldiers listed missing, captured, or killed when a maintenance company convoy made a wrong turn and came under attack from Iraqi tanks and fighters. A military spokesperson said today 11 bodies were found with Lynch in the commando raid on an Iraqi hospital. Some of them are believed to be Americans. Lynch was 19 years old when she joined the Army to get an education. She left a farming community in Palestine, West Virginia, with an unemployment rate of 15%. The New York Daily News reports that the U.S. military has come up with a solution for the penniless people of Umkhazar who are begging for water. Sell it. Despite general mayhem at distribution points, including knife fights, the Army has struck a hasty agreement with local Iraqis to expedite water distribution. Under the deal, the military will provide water free to locals with access to tanker trucks, who then will be allowed to sell the water for, quote, a reasonable fee. Army Colonel David Bassert said, quote, this provides them with an incentive to hustle and work. The U.S. military has authorized troops to detain Iraqi civilians who, quote, interfere with mission accomplishment. Under the new guidelines, suspects can be treated similarly to POWs and held up to 30 days. A group of Yemeni volunteers in Iraq vowed today to launch suicide attacks against invading U.S. and British troops. Reuters reports a group of 35 Yemenis in military uniform marched to the Palestine Hotel in central Baghdad, where foreign journalists are staying. The BBC reports the Iraqi embassy in Algiers is being inundated with inquiries from young Algerians who want to fight against the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Syria announced it's chosen to support the Iraqi people against the invasion of Iraq. The announcement follows a new warning by Secretary of State General Colin Powell, who told Syria it now faces a, quote, critical choice. And hundreds are killed by U.S. bombing, this according to the BBC. Doctors at a hospital in central Iraq have told the BBC they have dealt with more than 250 fatalities since the start of the U.S.-led war with Iraq. Officials at the Saddam Hussein Hospital in Nasiriyah said all of the deaths were the result of American bombing, and most were civilians. Secretary of State General Colin Powell is in Ankara. He warned Turkey it will have trouble securing $1 billion in proposed U.S. aid unless it cooperates with the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Powell wants Turkey to agree not to send troops into northern Iraq. The Washington Post reports Powell's remarks were the first time an administration official has tied the aid request to Turkey's cooperation in the war. South Korean lawmakers today authorized the dispatch of non-combat troops to support the U.S. invasion. Outside parliament, hundreds of people protested. A new poll by the French newspaper Le Monde has found that one-third of the French people desire an Iraqi victory over U.S. and British forces. And this news from the Daily Mirror of Britain. The father of a U.S. Marine yesterday blamed George Bush for his son's death. Fernando Suarez de Solar said U.S. officials had refused to give his family any details on how 22-year-old Lance Corporal Jesus died, other than it was at Nasiriyah. He said President Bush hasn't shown that this war is necessary. He has shown that this war is for the U.S. and to have the oil. Fernando moved his family to California from Mexico 6 years ago, adding, "This never would have happened if I didn't come to this country." And finally, some 3,000 U.S. troops are engaged in fighting with Taliban soldiers in the southeastern province of Kandahar. Posters bearing the endorsement of Taliban leader Mullah Omar have reportedly begun appearing in the province, calling for renewed jihad against American troops stationed in the region.
Thousands of mothers' lives when their sons go off to fight, and
War, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. With thousands of protesters outside, the Supreme Court began hearing arguments on two landmark cases that will likely decide the future of affirmative action. The stakes are high. The court could prohibit affirmative action programs at all universities, public and private, across the country. The court could allow the programs to continue, or the court could pronounce new standards for evaluating programs on a case-by-case basis. New York Times reports it appears, based on yesterday's proceedings, affirmative action will survive its most important test in a quarter of a century. Most notably, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who is widely viewed as holding the likely swing vote in the decision, raised a series of skeptical questions to the lawyers arguing against affirmative action. The court is hearing a pair of cases involving the admissions policy of the University of Michigan. The case names are Grutter versus Bollinger and Gratz versus Bollinger. Grutter is a challenge to the university's law school admissions program, which gives African American, Latino, and Native American applicants a loosely defined special consideration to ensure that there is a, quote, critical mass of such students in each new class. Gratz is a challenge to the university's undergraduate admissions policy, which tries to ensure a, quote, critical mass of African American, Latino, and Native American enrollments by giving such applicants an automatic 20-point bonus on the school's 150-point selection index. Let's begin by hearing some of yesterday's arguments. This is an excerpt of Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy quizzing Kirk Colbo, the attorney for the plaintiffs in Grutter versus Bollinger, who is joining us live, which challenges the University of Michigan Law School's affirmative action program. It begins with attorney Kirk Colbo.
It is precisely because we are a nation teeming with different races and ethnicities, one that is increasingly interracial, multiracial, that it is so crucial for our government to honor its solemn obligation to treat all members of our society equally without preferring some individuals over others.
Well, of course, a university or a law school is faced with a serious problem when it's one that gets thousands of applications for just a few slots, where it has to be selected.
Without regard to race, but race because, Your Honor, of the constitutional command of equality must be beyond the bounds for the
university. Say that's not, it can't be a factor at all. Is that it? Is that your position, that it cannot be one of many factors?
Our view, Your Honor, is that race itself should not be a factor, among others, in choosing students because of the
Constitution. Well, you have some precedents out there that you have to come to grips with, because the court obviously has upheld the use of race in making selections or choices in certain contexts, for instance, to remedy prior to discrimination and in other contexts.
Oh, absolutely, so, Your Honor.
All right.
And I want to be clear about that.
But you're speaking in absolutes, and it isn't quite that. I think we have given recognition to the use of race in a variety of settings.
And we absolutely agree, Justice O'Connor.
Well, is it cause for concern if you're the dean of the law school or the president of the university or the governor of the state minority students, particularly from the Black and Hispanic community, are underrepresented by a large factor, according to their share of the population? Suppose you have a law school with 2 or 3% Hispanic and Black students. Is that a legitimate concern for the university and for the state officials?
We believe not, Your Honor, for the reason that we need to get away from the notion that there is some right number for each racial group.
Year after year after year, there's an underrepresentation, there is no cause for the state or the government or its educational experts to be concerned whatsoever?
I wouldn't say not to be concerned, Your Honor. I think the mere fact of underrepresentation, that is that, say, blacks are not represented as they are in the population, is not a concern that would justify racial preferences. It certainly would justify perhaps broad social and political concerns.
Well, it's a broad social and political concern that they're not adequate members of a profession, which is designed to protect our rights and to promote progress. I should think that's a very legitimate concern on the part of the state.
The current concern there, Your Honor, ought to be addressed by addressing the problem. If there is some reason that particular minority groups are not participating as fully in the fruits of our society, such as being represented at the schools, we need to address those problems. But racial preferences don't address those problems.
Kirk Colbo, lead counsel for the Center for Individual Rights, being questioned by Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy. We'll be joined by Kirk Colbo live after the break, along with the lead attorney for the Student Defenders of Affirmative Action from the University of Michigan. You are listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones,
we are the ones,
we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones,
we are the ones,
we've been waiting.
We are the ones,
we are the ones,
we've been waiting.
We are the ones,
we are the ones,
we've been waiting.
We are the ones, sweet honey in the rock, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to our guests, Kirk Colbo, the lead counsel for the Center for Individual Rights that argued against affirmative action at the Supreme Court yesterday. Miranda Massey, lead attorney for the Student Defenders of Affirmative Action at the University of Michigan Law School. We're also joined on the line by Agnes Aliabua, who was involved with the case when she was still in high school and now is a student at the University of Michigan. Let's begin with Kirk Colbo. The kinds of questions you received yesterday, your major argument against affirmative action. Can you lay it out?
Our major argument is that the Constitution provides that individuals should not be discriminated against on the basis of their race, and that's precisely what these university admission policies do. They treat people for no other reason than their race very differently in the admissions process, and they do it in a way that also amounts to using race to achieve a quota. And we believe that that's just forbidden by the Constitution.
Miranda Massey, you're a lead attorney for the student defending affirmative action.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you lay out your case?
Our case is this. The affirmative action plan in place at the University of Michigan Law School is extremely narrowly tailored, and it has the effect of offsetting what would otherwise be very systematic racial bias in admissions, systematic unearned advantages for white applicants because of the racial bias in standardized test scores and grades. And we also say that affirmative action is absolutely necessary if we're going to continue making progress toward integration and equality in all the institutions of our society. In other words, it's necessary if we're going to continue to stand on the promise of Brown versus Board of Ed.
Kirk Colbo.
Well, the fundamental problem there is if the university is relying upon discriminatory criteria, then it ought to stop using them. What it should not do is use those criteria and apply one standard to one group based on their race and a different standard to another group. And that's the fundamental problem with their policies.
And that's a superficial argument because the reality is, and we proved this at trial, until we have a race-neutral world, there won't be any race-neutral academic criteria on which universities can rely. Yes, it would be a step in the right direction if they were to eliminate the use of standardized tests, and some schools have done that on the undergraduate level. Meanwhile, the American Bar Association requires that law schools use the LSAT in admissions, Every law school does it, and we all know they're all going to continue to do it. The real question, there will be elite law schools. The real question is whether they'll be reserved for white people.
There's nothing that requires law schools to put any particular emphasis on test scores, and we're never going to get to a race-neutral society as long as we're practicing discrimination the way the university is.
The only way forward is to integrate. The solution, so-called, offered by the plaintiffs in these cases is to resegregate higher education in the name of moving us closer to a world where there's no discrimination. That's just senseless.
Well, we know that's not true because we have universities in Texas, California, and Florida where race is not being used as a factor, and the level of representation is comparable or sometimes exceeding that which is at the University of Michigan. So it's just the argument about resegregation is a very unfortunate and inflammatory one, but it's totally untrue.
Well, Kirk, last year there were two black graduates from the University of California at Los Angeles School of Law. UCLA Law School had two black graduates. There have been one, two, and zero black person graduating classes from all of the law schools in California where affirmative action has been eliminated. There are fewer black people at the University of Texas Law School now than there were before Brown versus Board of Ed after Sweat v. Painter desegregated UT law. The fact is, the elimination of affirmative action has resegregated higher education in the jurisdictions where it's been carried out, and the numbers show that. The listeners can just check the websites for the different states. And in fact, Jeb Bush in the state of Florida decided to found two distinct law schools, one for Latinos and one for black people in Florida, after eliminating affirmative action because he knew that the University of Florida Law School was going to resegregate. So now you have the University of Florida Law School, flagship state school with long tradition and 115 professors, and a Latino law school at Florida International with 12 professors, and a black law school at Florida A&M with 8 professors. That's separate and unequal education.
Well, again, I think that those facts aren't true, and I agree. If people are interested in the facts, they should take a look at the official information off the websites of these universities. At Bolt Hall, for example, this year they have a underrepresented minority population defined in the same way that the University of Michigan does, totaling 19%, which is well above what the University of Michigan gets. There's not one right number for any one racial group, and you will, for demographic reasons, have differences. It's true that there are fewer black students, for example, in some of these California and Texas schools, but it's also true that those schools have many, many more Hispanic students than the University of Michigan does with its heavy use of preferences. So we need to get away from this notion that there's just one right number for each racial group.
In the state of California, the state of California is the first state in the nation to be majority-minority, as many listeners will be aware. The numbers at Bolt are completely unacceptable. They have risen this year, and they have risen also at UCLA this year. And the reason why, to put it very bluntly, is that both of those schools are engaged in practicing affirmative action by another name. The numbers up until this year have been abysmal. They've risen very slightly this year. They're not up to where they were before the elimination of affirmative action, and they are absolutely unacceptable when you look at the changing demographics of those states, which are a forecast for the changing demographics of the nation. They're nowhere near where they should be. But that said, they have risen some. The only reason is that those schools are engaged in race-conscious admissions practices. And if we were to lose the University of Michigan Law School case, there is absolutely no question in my mind, and I'm certain there isn't any question in Kirk's either, that those schools will stop doing the end runs around the elimination of affirmative action that they are currently doing, and we would be back to graduating two black people, one black person per year from UCLA as we had last year. That is a non-starter. That is completely unacceptable.
We have just no reason at all to believe that these universities who are operating under rules of law that prohibit the use of race are in fact doing an end run around them. There's simply no evidence of that.
We have every reason to believe that. The University of California Los Angeles Law School started a program designed to attract minority students. It has a separate admissions policy, and it's a program in which students can study critical race studies. It has admitted a far greater percentage of minority students than the regular admissions program. Not all of the students admitted under it are minorities. Some of them are white. But it is clearly designed to offset the impact of losing affirmative action, and it is almost publicly acknowledged. to be
well, it's not,
designed
it's not
for that
the record
purpose.
Of this case.
And in the University of Texas, just in the Texas 10% plan, is clearly designed to temper the impact of losing affirmative action, relies on the segregation in K-12 education throughout the state of Texas, and has been threatened with legal challenge by fellow travelers of the Center for Individual Rights. None of these alternatives is race neutral. None of them is intended to achieve race neutral results, and they shouldn't. We can't have race neutral admissions until we have achieved equality in society. Until that time, we will have segregated education unless we use affirmative action.
We're never going to get to equality as long as we're treating people unequally on the basis of race. That's the problem.
Well, we are listening to Kirk Colbo, lead counsel for the Center for Individual Rights, who argued the case against affirmative action before the Supreme Court yesterday. Miranda Massey, lead attorney for the student defenders in the University of Michigan Law School case. We're also joined by Agnes Aliabua, who is a student at the University of Michigan, got involved in this case in high school. Agnes, can you explain why this case is important to you?
This case is a basic question of fairness and equality in our society, and it will decide the future of race relations in America. The way we've been phrasing it is that these cases have the opportunity to be our Brown versus Board of Education, a huge step forward for the country, or it could be our Plessy v. Ferguson, where the court has made legal segregation, and it'd be a huge step back for the country as a whole. And I just think that these cases have been so important because of the numbers, the thousands and thousands of high school, college, and middle school students across the country who have decided because of these cases that they can stand up and fight against racism and really build a new civil rights movement that can change our entire society.
What about the response of the justices yesterday? I'd like to get a comment first from Agnes and hearing the case. Did you have a sense that the justices, which direction that they were going, the kinds of questions that they asked?
I was actually outside of the court yesterday, and so my report from the justices I just got this morning from the little clip that you guys aired, but I know that the court is aware of the 50,000 people who were marching outside yesterday. They're aware of the number of petition signatures that people have signed across the country in support of affirmative action. And I'm sure that the court was abuzz with activity and interest and the students who are outside. And we know that this court is human. These justices are human beings. They're impacted and affected by what goes on in the society. They have family members. They have children who will be watching the news, who saw all the people who are outside. And I know that the massive civil rights march that we had yesterday will definitely have a huge impact and be a huge weight on the justices' decision.
We had a Howard University student organizer on yesterday. Jesse Jackson also addressed the crowds. Al Sharpton also did. Where did all the students come from?
I'm a member of BAM. It stands for the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action, Integration, and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary. And basically, since the cases have started, we've had a twofold method. One, we have to fight in the court. We have to get our arguments heard in the courtroom. So that's why we're student interveners. And then the second approach was that we had to win in the streets. We had to be building a new civil rights movement that would be strong enough to impact these conservative courts. And since the cases started, we've been going to college campuses, to high schools, making presentations about these cases, letting students know how they can get involved, that they can be leaders in the society, that we can stand up to George Bush, we can stand up to the Supreme Court and make a difference. And the last couple of months, kind of since January, we've just been in a dogged campaign to get as many people out to D.C. as possible, and that's meant that people have gone to California, to Oklahoma, to Florida, to New York, just all over the country, talking to as many people as possible to get them to come to D.C., and we see the fruits of the organizing of students, literally thousands of students across the country. We saw the fruits of that organizing yesterday.
Would you say that affirmative action has affected you in your own life?
Absolutely. I would not be at the University of Michigan if they did not have race-conscious affirmative action policies. I'm from Detroit. I went to high school in Detroit, and the schools in the city of Detroit are just not the same. And Mr. Coble is trying to say that this is unconstitutional. And what's unconstitutional and what's unfair and undemocratic is the vast difference in education between the black youth and Latino youth of this country and the white youth, the wealthy white youth of this country. That I could go to school in 2000, I graduated in 99, go to school in 1999, and be taught my math class by a football coach, or go to a school and not have an accounting book when class starts in the semester, or have to go to Borders to buy English books to read for the semester, that we can live in a society where students go to school and don't use the internet and don't use email. That's inequality. That's unconstitutional. And affirmative action is the only thing that takes that into account, takes into account the segregation that we face in society, and not just in education, but the racism and segregation that black and minority people face in society in general, and make sure that they have equal opportunity to attend a place like the University of Michigan. And I know without that consideration for segregation and racism, without race-conscious admissions policies, I would not be at U of M myself.
I would like to ask now about the issues raised by the Supreme Court justices. How did you think Miranda Massey, lead attorney for the student defenders at University of Michigan Law School, the questioning went? What was the emphasis? Did you take heart or not?
I did. I did take heart. I thought first that I think pretty much everybody thinks that Sandra Day O'Connor is a critical potential swing vote on these cases, and it's possible that Justice Kennedy could also be a swing vote of sorts, or a sixth vote, along with Justice O'Connor. I thought that Justice O'Connor was extremely skeptical of, and I might even go so far as to say hostile to, the plaintiff's position that race can never be a factor except to remedy a given institution's own past unlawful discrimination. It's certainly not what the precedents have held, but our opponents have been trying to enshrine that completely unrealistic and unworkable and retrograde principle into the law, and it's pretty clear from yesterday's questioning that that will not happen.
Kirk Colbo, your response to the questions.
I don't think you can read anything into questions. They were all very good questions. Justice O'Connor also asked some very important questions of the university about the fact that their policies have no end in sight, which has been a very important consideration in whether race is being used in a proper fashion. Their use of race is indefinite. It will go on permanently, perpetually. And Justice O'Connor expressed, at least through her questions, some concerns about that, which we think are very valid concerns. We indicated in my response to Justice O'Connor, we've not taken the view that there is some absolute rule against the use of race under any circumstances. What we argued in this case was that the university's use of race, for the reasons that they've articulated them, are improper, for the same reasons that the court has struck down the use of race in other contexts, like, for example, using race to provide role models to school children. So I don't think one can read much into the questions in terms of how the justices will ultimately vote on the case.
I had a question for you, Kirk Colbo. Michael Kinsley had an interesting piece where he said the Wall Street Journal reported that Harvard accepts 40% of applicants who are children of alumni, but only 11% of applicants generally. And this kind of affirmative action makes the student body less diverse, not more so. And then it goes on to say George W. Bush, in fact, may be the most spectacular affirmative action success story of all time, saying it wasn't because of his academic achievement, his high school record ordinary, wasn't because because of his life experience, prosperous family, fancy prep school, which was all too familiar at Yale, wasn't his SAT scores, 566 verbal, 640 math. They may not have had an explicit point system at Yale in 64, but Bush clearly got in because of affirmative action. Affirmative action for the son and grandson of alumni, affirmative action for a member of a politically influential family, affirmative action for a boy from a fancy prep school. These forms of affirmative action still go on. I was wondering if you would also be challenging that policy of the acceptance, for example, of giving preference to applicants of children of alumni.
No, for a very simple reason. There's nothing in the Constitution about that. Universities may make many bad choices about how they form their student body that we can do nothing about because there's no legal cause of action. We have a 14th Amendment that prohibits discrimination on the basis of race. It does not prohibit discrimination on the basis of alumni preferences. Now, having said that, if we decide or if a university decides that these alumni preferences are discriminatory and unfair, then the solution is to get rid of them. The solution is not to simply set up a whole different regime of preferences that also, or in this case, violate the Constitution.
Miranda Massey.
Admissions absent affirmative action is a white privilege racket. It's chock full of unearned advantages for white applicants. Those can absolutely be challenged under civil rights statutes, and so it's disingenuous to act as if there's no potential legal challenge there. The truth is that the Center for Individual Rights and its fellow travelers on the extreme right have opted only to challenge those elements of the admission system that take a step toward fairness, that take a step toward offsetting that regime of unearned white advantage. And we think that it's going to be absolutely necessary to sue universities on the basis of their admissions criteria if we lose affirmative action. There's no question about that. That'll have to be undertaken. As things stand now, the use of affirmative action policies means that those unfairnesses and inequalities are offset to some extent, but they're absolutely subject to legal challenge. And if the Center for Individual Rights were in a genuine way concerned about the elements of admissions that are unfair to minorities, it could have sued to try to end them long ago.
Well, Miranda might have filed the same lawsuit then rather than filed her as interveners in this case, and they have not taken on these preferences.
There's affirmative action in place. We haven't needed to do that.
Well, still discriminate. These alumni preferences still discriminate in your judgment, and if there's something wrong with that, then and you believe that there's a legal cause of action, you're free to file those lawsuits.
There won't be a need to do that unless we lose affirmative action. If we lose affirmative action, there will be an immediate need to do that. Otherwise, we'll see complete resegregation. But the truth is only race-conscious action can make admissions fair in the end. You could eliminate the alumni preference and the preference that was also profiled in the Wall Street Journal on the front page for exceptionally rich young people whose parents make large donations and all the other white preference elements of admissions. And because the basic admissions criteria, the academic criteria, are still shot through with bias, you still would need affirmative action to offset that inequality and unfairness.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Miranda Massey, lead attorney for the student defenders in the University of Michigan Law School case. Kirk Colbo, lead counsel for the Center for Individual Rights, which he argued against affirmative action before the Supreme Court yesterday. And Agnes Aliobua, who is a student now at the University of Michigan and speaking to us after being outside the Supreme Court yesterday with tens of thousands of other students from around the country. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we will go to a conversation with an embedded reporter who has just returned. Stay with us.
At midnight, in a flaming, angry town, I saw my country's flag lying torn upon the ground. I ran in and dodged among the crowd and scooped it up and scampered out to safety. And then I took this striped old piece of cloth and tried my best to wash the garbage off. But I found it had been used for wrapping lies. It smelled and stank and attracted all the flies.
while I was feverishly at my task. I heard a husky voice that seemed to ask, "Do you think you could change me just a bit?" Betsy Ross did her best, but she made a few mistakes. My blue is good, the color of the sky.
The Torn Flag by John Trudell here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Jeremy Scahill, just back from Baghdad. It's a new term that has now become a household phrase in America, embedded journalists, reporters who are traveling with U.S. forces as they move through Iraq. There are currently more than 500 embeds in Iraq and northern Kuwait. More than 1,200 other journalists are covering the war as what the Pentagon calls unilaterals, journalists not with U.S. forces or not officially accredited by the Pentagon. Many of the embeds are now deep into Iraq with divisions of the U.S. military, and it's very difficult for them to leave what the Pentagon calls the theater of operation. But our next guest is one of the few embeds that did leave the front lines and has returned home to the United States. We welcome you very much, Jolene Espinoza, and welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. So can you talk about, first of all, when you went to Iraq, and just describe very briefly your experience there?
Initially, I was embedded with the 1st Tank Battalion, United States Marine Corps, in northern Kuwait, and there was about a week, I guess you would say, before the war started, our first mission within my small tow missile platoon of about 24 men was to guard the Iraqi-Kuwaiti border. And at that time, prior to the war starting, we actually experienced some hostilities and were attacked as we were guarding the border. There were also, to sort of paint the picture in terms of the firing upon civilian populations and the casualties that have happened, as you mentioned earlier, is that the Marine Corps was told that the Iraqi Republican Guard was infiltrating the homes in southern Iraq and posing as civilians and going to attack the Marines. However, there was no direction whatsoever to fire upon them. In fact, the rules were not to really be fired or to fire upon them until the Marines were actually under attack. And I saw that with my own eyes. I saw the restraint that was exercised. As the war progressed, we began to come under attack more and more frequently by these Iraqi Republican Guard posing as civilians. And again, the message that the Marines wanted me to bring back was just really what an incredibly difficult situation, as there weren't enough people there, military people, to essentially go in and root out those Iraqi Republican Guard forces. So essentially, we were moving forward into northern Iraq, meanwhile leaving sort of the rear exposed. And then, as you notice, there's more and more attacks on our forces. And as a result, the paranoia factor gets higher, and we have these civilian casualties that are, of course, unintended.
And how did you travel in?
Essentially, they traveled in just up the major roads and highways of Iraq.
Which, in tank?
No, I personally was in a Humvee with a tow missile, which is like a cruise missile mounted on top. There was a 19-year-old driver, a 24-year-old vehicle commander, and myself, and we lived in that Humvee.
Tired were they? All of you?
Extremely exhausted. These men would basically get an hour of sleep at a time and then trade off in terms of guarding the vehicle, guarding their battalion. And the problem there again was the vigilance had to be so high because of these sort of, I guess you would call them, guerrilla type tactics that were really unforeseen in terms of the impact that they were having. They suspected that they would be in Baghdad in a few days, or hopefully not even have to go into Baghdad. But as they became under attack, the movement was slowed significantly, and of course, more and more casualties on both sides.
Where did the forces that you were traveling with first encounter resistance?
First encountered resistance, well, on the border before actually entering into Iraq. And then after the first day of the war, essentially, initially the reception was very positive by the Iraqi people that the Marines encountered, handing out water, food, aid, very much mixing in with the military population. The next morning is when our small camp came under mortar attack, and there were three serious injuries, almost one fatality, when they initially got the wake-up call that this was going to be a very difficult and long war. And what had happened was the Iraqi Republican Guard had actually infiltrated an entire neighborhood, had a whole command structure with armaments in that neighborhood, and we just happened to stumble into it and camp in their backyard, essentially.
The Marines expect to encounter the resistance? They do.
Yes, they do. And again, that's a very significant concern. Of course, the idea was, according to them, was that they would eventually progress towards Baghdad, meet the Medina forces, the 42nd, and that there would be a surrender. And now it appears that these Medina forces have dispersed themselves. When we were paralyzed by sandstorms, they were able to move and disperse, and that the fight will likely go to the streets of Baghdad, which of course they're extremely, extremely concerned about, as the civilian casualty potential and just a very difficult, as they say, Vietnam-like scenario where you cannot determine friend from foe.
We're talking to Sholene Espinoza. She was reporting in Iraq, an embedded reporter, former U-2 pilot and military jet instructor, working as an embedded reporter for Talk Radio News Service based in Washington, D.C. There's been a whole debate over the last few days about whether the Pentagon, whether Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had micromanaged overruling generals in not getting enough support to soldiers in Iraq. You talked about being tired, the soldiers being tired. Was there enough support there on the ground, and was that kind of discussion going on among the troops?
That discussion was definitely going along, and no, frankly. And here's what the situation in any war: there are going to be unintended consequences, and the war game, you know, to use a phrase, will change. And before we ever actually entered in Iraq, the road that they had intended to take was blown up. So the whole war plan sort of changed at that moment. And what happened was they predicted that they would just be able to check through military objectives, leave the British forces behind to take care of the humanitarian effort and the prisoners of war, Iraqi prisoners of war. In reality, what they found was they could get through the military objectives, but then there was this entire resistance group remaining, which continually started to take shots at the military. And then, of course, the civilian population paid the price, as they could no longer hand out the humanitarian aid, as it wasn't safe. And I saw that with my own eyes, not able to give the aid to the people that we had promised to them, because there was a whole sense of threat, in other words, from these Iraqi Republican Guard members. So it was essentially a no-win situation. They were leaving entire Iraqi tanks intact, for example, which sort of shows the almost the arrogance, if you will, thinking that if they leave these military infrastructure intact for a post-war Iraq, that we'll need a military. Essentially, was what the idea was. In reality, of course, it doesn't appear that there's going to be a stable post-war Iraq anytime soon. So the mindset going in was very different than what they encountered.
So you have civilians being shot at, but the tanks remaining intact.
That's right. And again, in terms of the civilians being shot at, I think it's very important to distinguish that the rules of engagement were very strict as to minimizing, preventing at all costs. I mean, I listened on the radios and experienced fire back and forth, and denied the order to shoot on civilians, even when they appeared to have weapons, until we were fired upon. Of course, over time, that happens again and again and again, and then the rules start to loosen, and that is what has happened, because there's no one there to go and root out those forces, almost like an Al-Qaeda type of an operation. So they're essentially left to fight, exposing the military.
Can you talk about the limitations, what it meant to be an embedded reporter, your relationship with the Marines?
Yes. I took the approach that I wanted to go in at the lowest level of command structure in terms of being able to really see what these men were living through. And also, as you might imagine, to go into combat is probably the most difficult situation that you can face as a human being, or to be on the other side of the conflict as the Iraqi people. And so what I did was I lived with them, I worked with them, I got to know their families, their pictures, their political views, and be really accepted as one of their family members in order to be able to experience the war completely.
I wanted to ask you, in the south of Iraq, the population, as we all know, is overwhelmingly Shiite. But the leading Shiite clerics in Iraq, more than 500 of them, issued a fatwa last year calling for jihad against American forces. And these were not simply insignificant clerics that were under the wing or patronage of Saddam Hussein. There were some extraordinarily significant figures in the entire sect of Shiite Islam. And they essentially told the people of the south of Iraq to fight against U.S. forces when they come in. Now, we hear these reports of Republican Guard or Fedayeen Saddam dressing up as civilians and attacking U.S. forces. But also, I met many civilians in the south of Iraq who said they were anti-Saddam, but that if they saw a U.S. soldier, they would shoot them. How do they know these are Fedayeen Saddam and Republican Guards and not civilian militias that quite well could be opposed to Saddam Hussein as well?
Yes, excellent question. From my own experience, it was the way they determined it was they actually found elements of the Republican Guard, either supplies or uniforms on them. For example, two detainees had Republican Guard berets with special operations imprinted in their berets. Also, physically speaking, you could distinguish with your own eyes. The Iraqi Republican Guard members are very confident, very well fed, very robust men versus the Iraqi people in that region were extremely thin and hungry, really, and just a very sort of an impoverished people. And it was a very clear distinction from what we could see, or what I could see with my own eyes. In terms of that Iraqi resistance, I could, you know, definitely relate to what you're saying. But in terms of what I saw, it seemed that they were more interested in having their children taken care of. They would push them up to us for medical care and obviously to get some food and water. But they were very skittish because, of course, they're not completely confident that the U.S. is going to take care of them.
You're a former U-2 pilot, and you flew combat missions over Iraq?
Yes.
In the Persian Gulf?
Yes, I did.
War.
Not in the Gulf War, after that in 1993 through 95, and UN inspection missions as well.
So what was it like then to go back as a reporter, as an embedded reporter?
It was it was a privilege, really, to from the air above 70,000 feet. I could see the in some areas, not in Iraq because we were not under war at that time, but in Bosnia, for example, the fire and the rockets beneath me, thinking of the horror of war. To actually experience it at the ground level, you know, the expression "war is hell" is I think the most accurate expression there is, and I experienced that.
Well, Charlene Espinosa, I want to thank you for being with us. Former U-2 pilot, flew combat missions over Iraq, now an embedded reporter for Talk Radio News in Iraq, just returned after getting sick there. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That does it for the show. If you'd like to get a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Our producers, Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Noah Reibel, also Jenny DeFilippazzo, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Our email address, mail, mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening.